it's no real surprise to learn that we're hearing In the Hall of the Mountain King by Norwegian composer Edvard Grieg. It's a sound he's mostly known for, this sound, and his powerful piano concerto. Even in his own day, as Susan McClary tells us, the mainstream happily consumed Grieg's folk-based music as one might collect postcards from exotic sites. But at the same time, it minimized the significance of his unmarked music, that is, pieces without an obvious folk-like fingerprint. In suggesting there's a true tension in Grieg's work, the folk-centered sound and the so-called unmarked music, Daniel Grimley takes us to Trollhagen and points out the physical tension between Grieg's villa, his earthly dwelling place, and that of his final resting place. Grimley says, composers' final resting places can often provide valuable insights into their historical reception and the context in which their music was originally created. Grieg's grave is a case in point. It consists of a simple stone tablet with a heavy lintel set into the dark granite cliff below his villa, Troll Hill, looking out over the waters towards the outer Skerries and the open sea. Designed by Grieg's cousin, architect Schack Bull, Grieg's name is carved in stylized runic letters across the face of the stone, evoking the golden age of Norway's Viking past. In some senses, the grave is an anti-memorial, an object that at least appears to resist its conventional cultural function. By comparison with the popular image of Grieg outside Norway, an idealization of the composer surrounded by picturesque fjordland scenery, promoted most notoriously perhaps by the Broadway musical Song of Norway, there is no image or statue of the composer, and no attempt to soften the stark geometric lines of Bull's design. The contrast with the familiar vernacular style of Troll Hill above could not be greater. Daniel Grimley, writing about Edvard Grieg's grave in Grieg, Music, Landscape, and Norwegian Identity. It's as if Ryan Weber has been climbing those cliffs and exploring the significance of Grieg's place, his place in many senses, geographical, cultural, political, and of course his musical place in the Western tradition, during his lifetime right up to our own. And Dr. Weber has set down his findings in a recent book titled Cosmopolitanism and Transatlantic Circles in Music and Literature, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Dr. Weber is Assistant Professor of Musicology in the Department of Fine Arts and a member of the Medical and Health Humanities Program at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, just outside Wilkes-Barre. And his study compares American and European responses to nationalism around 1900 and how music and literature help nations create a source of identity. The book traces the transatlantic networks that were constructed between a select group of composers, including Edvard Grieg, Edward MacDowell, and Percy Grainger, and the writers with whom they shared international affinities. We've just spent time at the gravesite of Edvard Grieg, and as it happens, today, February 20th, marks the 58th anniversary of the death of composer Percy Grainger. He passed away in 1961 in White Plains, New York, and perhaps this is music too peppy for that occasion, and yet it is one of the pieces he's most well known for. While there might have been a real complexity and richness in Grieg's wrestling with his musical voice and legacy, there were real and troubling conflicts in Percy Grainger's coming to terms with his art and craft. Dr. Weber shares this informal manifesto from Percy Grainger, who says, "My musical creed is musical democracy. My definition of democracy being a chance for all to shine in a starry whole. I would like each voice at all times throughout my music to enjoy equal importance and prominence. If this cannot be realized, I would like each voice at given moments to have its moments of prominence and importance, no less than all the other voices. In other words, the ideal of equality is the keystone of my musical endeavors. In my free music, the only music of mine to which I attach importance, I strive to tally the irregularity, the formlessness, and the unforeknowableness of nature as it is revealed to us. The driving force behind my work as a composer is racialism and nationalism. I would not write any music at all if it were not to express the unity of the Nordic, blue-eyed race, wherever found, to express the tragic position of the Nordic race, outnumbered in a hostile world, and in the hopes of bringing honor and fame to my native land, Australia." Words of Percy Grainger. Dr. Ryan Weber paid a visit to the WVIA Public Media Studios to talk with us about Edvard Grieg and Percy Grainger, and to help us see what these artistic struggles, the artistic struggles of their day, might say to us in our day. First, how Dr. Weber was drawn to these composers.
There are many things that got me into this project and that have kept me here for so long. One of which is actually a change from where I started. As many musicologists do, we studied nationalism throughout the 19th century. Huge school, right? All these different schools of thought. And one of the prevalent modes of thought has been that, well, if you weren't in one of these mainstream cultural centers, you probably belong to a nationalist school. And this is how different icons got their identity. These are the labels that we as musicologists have used to understand these different figures that have existed throughout time. And one of the things I got very interested in was the extent to which, looking at primary sources, so many musicians felt themselves to be part, yes, indeed, of a national school, to be part of a national identity, but also part of an international community. And that is at once an obvious statement, right? We're all part of some larger group, and it doesn't seem too significant. But one of the things that we've clearly done in scholarship is we've, I think, sometimes privileged, as I refer to in the book, the layer, the national layer, more than other layers. So one of the things I sought to examine is a transatlantic network of different artists, musicians, literary figures, who, yes, indeed had a national layer, some more prominent than others, but really, I think the right word would be struggled to bring another layer to the surface. And that layer we call cosmopolitanism. That's their term, not necessarily just scholars. But of course, what that means could vary. There is no strict definition, just like there's no real strict definition of what it is to be a nationalist composer. And that's what I sought to try to examine, is how does that term evolve? What did it mean for these figures? What does it mean on one side of the Atlantic? And how does that compare to someone living over here? And of course, how does that change over time, especially as we're looking at something, the run-up to 1900, right, the end of the century, the rise of industrialism and nationalism in some cultures, the United States and in Britain. And of course, how does the onset of World War I change all of that in different ways?
For example,
the examples that I look at, for instance, would be Edvard Grieg, and looking at both Norway, which was struggling to find its independence and actually does earn it, if we could use that term, in 1905, and how that would overlap with the sense of Scandinavianism. So yes, they were trying to separate from their neighbors, but they also needed their neighbors. And of course, we could go on forever, or I could go on forever about Scandinavia, but it's an interesting situation. They separate politically from Sweden, but, you know, the person that they put back in power has ties to Denmark, which is where they started in the first place. So you've got this kind of Scandinavian layer here, which at times works together, but also works apart. And then we have in the United States at the same time a growing nationalist trend. But there's a lot of questions among artists as to what does it mean to be an American school, right? That's not so clear. And actually what I point out, or what I try to point out, is that that's not clear in other places either. It's not as clear, even in a place like France or in a place like Norway, what it means to be Norwegian. And this is the heart of their question, which is at once ideological, but it is, and I try to demonstrate in this book, it's also practical, you know, and to show both sides of those. It's not just a question they're sitting back pondering. This has real results and really affects the day-to-day interactions in their lives.
Let's go to Greek. What about the use of folk materials in Greek?
Boy, it's such a complex topic, and I hate to use that term, and I'm not trying to hide under it, but what did he mean? I mean, that is the core of what I've been trying to understand, and I think that changed for him over the course of his life. It didn't mean what it did in his youth as when it did when, you know, he eventually passed away in 1907. But if I can kind of set the stage, he becomes famous at a relatively young age writing a rather dramatic-based work, his piano concerto, right? I mean, that's a form that all classical musicians use. As a pianist, I played that many times, right? Everybody, I think, is familiar with that work. And he gets both an identity and also a legacy in writing a lot of nationally based music, right? There's no doubt about that. So I'm not here to displace that. That's never been my goal at all. But, and there's a big but, he wants to do a lot more. So one of the questions that really got me kind of investigating this is what he does at the turn of the century in 1900. Now think about this. Norway is very, very, very much divided about how they move forward and how they create national independence. There's a lot of apathy in Norway, as we could imagine a lot of countries, about why they should leave their neighbors. We could almost, although I want to be careful here, but draw a parallel to the Brexit, right? How some people feel very passionate about leaving and others feel the sense of, you know, what difference is it going to make? And, you know, of course, these things tend to come to a head, right? And that's exactly what was going on around 1900. So what does he do? He doesn't write, well, just a few years before, he writes his famous folk song cycle, the Haugtussa cycle, and this again makes him famous, right? And it seems to put a stamp on the fact that he is a Norwegian artist through and through, and that's the be-all, end-all of it, right? But what does he do in 1900? Is he goes to Denmark, and he literally goes to a relatively unknown poet at this time, Ben Zone is his last name, who was very well tied into the intellectual circle there in Denmark. So he's very well known, but not really as a poet. And he sets Ben Zone's poetry to music. And as someone like this who's famous at this point, why would he turn to a relatively unknown poet outside of Norway at the height of independence to write these songs? And Grieg says a few things. I do think we need to take Grieg at his own word, unlike Percy Grainger, who I'll get to in a moment, in that he says, my new songs, which will come out this year, Opus 69 and 70, are thoroughly cosmopolitan in character. And he eventually does meet Percy Grainger, and they learn about that. And he says, you, Percy, understand what I have aimed to achieve. And I think Grieg felt that he was not complete with that mission of what it meant to be cosmopolitan in music. That is to say, to be national was relatively straightforward, not uncomplicated, not uncontested, but bringing folk influence, right? Bringing these different things into music, we were all very much accustomed to. But Grieg had another goal beyond that. And of course, critics in that time and since then have really dismissed these late works. They live in the shadow of his great song cycle, right? And what I've tried to understand, well, what are our values as scholars? We value paradigms that we know and we're comfortable with. The song cycle, right? Schubert popularized that. So to be a serious composer was to write in this serious form. So why was Grieg choosing to use a Danish text, which, by the way, is the language he spoke since birth, which is another whole issue altogether, at the height of Norwegian independence? And why have so many people dismiss these works as unartistic? And I'll just stop there, but there have been many other words thrown at him. So that's really what got me trying to understand what was going on, because he did this consciously. And I think he was very, very proud of what he was trying to do. And I do put that emphasis on trying because I do believe this is a process that he was involved in that he felt was not completed at his death.
In the study, you say there's a difference about being of Norway as opposed to from Norway.
Precisely, yes.
And so you can use the folk idiom, perhaps, or that language,
mm-hmm.
but you use it in a structural way.
Correct.
Rather than as a flag-waving
sure.
way.
Sure, precisely. Yeah, I mean, there's so many paradoxes here. And you look at someone like Grieg, which is not unlike, I think, anybody even in the world to this day. He's born into a middle-class family in a relatively urban area. And the language he speaks from birth is Dano-Norwegian, which is what had circulated for a long time. He did not speak these rural dialects. So for him, authenticity operated a very different way than for other people. And that's this game, which has unfortunately sometimes very serious consequences about who's an insider and who's an outsider. And this is why Grieg actually chastises a lot of times his fellow Norwegians. He gets in trouble because he's in charge of a Norwegian festival and he brings in an orchestra from Amsterdam. I mean, imagine if we did that today, right? How dare you do that? This is an American concert. We've got to have American players. And for Grieg, no, he wanted the best. Didn't matter, you know, where they came from. Didn't matter. That's why I think he was so open and receptive to Percy Grainger performing his work. He says, you don't have to be Norwegian to understand my music. And he even says that this harangue about having to be Norwegian is ridiculous. Furthermore, his own upbringing did not mean that he was used to these authentic, quote unquote, folk songs from his birth. He didn't learn them until much later on in his life, right? So it wasn't even part of his schooling. So he's got to learn and investigate something that's supposed to be natural. So there's a lot of back and forth that's taking place within these different factions within Norway. And of course, he's also trying to very consciously craft a way forward in art in an area that didn't have a long legacy of classical music. So you're looking at what's indigenous and how do I combine that with what will make me known beyond my shores, a legitimate composer. And that, I think, is the struggle for so many. How do we achieve that healthy blend?
Well, you alluded to Percy Grainger, and mm-hmm. that's a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm.
And if Grainger is, in one sense, also committed to the notion of cosmopolitanism, he somehow doesn't come to terms with it in a way that seems to be as healthy as Grieg.
Absolutely. So there's so many layers here. And I think some of the things to always be conscious of that are still relevant to this day is another term that's tied to this is universalism. What is universal? And I think there's two types of universalism. We use the same word, but we can mean it to mean very different things. What I try to delineate in the book is what might be termed universal participation, which is also tied to notions of democracy, the idea that everybody is represented or everybody participates. Okay, that's one type of universalism. But then there's another type of universalism that's called universal circulation. That is to say, find select traits and make those the dominant ones. Now, we use the word universalism and cosmopolitanism sometimes interchangeably with multiple different definitions. And that's what's so complicated here. I mean, just imagine this. Grieg is old now. He's been sick for quite a long time. He had a lot of breathing problems. And I think he knew at a certain point that he would not live that much longer, right? You know, at the turn of the 20th century here, he meets this young pianist who had everything to gain by this relationship. I mean, a young pianist. Meeting a well-known celebrity composer, even to this day, that could make your career pretty quickly. They do have a face-to-face meeting, and they seemingly have this hit it off right away. And Grieg writes to him and says, you understand what I've been trying to do. And I think Grieg felt that Percy Grainger could be the torchbearer for, not nationalism per se, but this idea of cosmopolitanism in music. And he uses that term. And Grainger later goes on to write articles about Grieg, the cosmopolitan, for several decades. Okay, so fine, right? What immediately happens literally after Grieg's death is the term Nordic starts to emerge with different meanings. And of course, when we use the term Nordic, we all are aware of there is no such thing as a Nordic country. And what's going on, of course, at this point is we're starting to see the definitions tilt from definitions of nationhood that were culturally based, which is to say you could participate or not participate, right? Their elective affinities, to something that starts to become biological based. And that's no longer something that is elective, right? That's something that is cast upon you at birth that you cannot change. So Grieg, of course, eschews that. Grieg was a lifelong, I think I could use the term, humanitarian. He fought back against growing currents of anti-Semitism, the Dreyfus Affair, and many other things throughout his life, and was never someone to buy into biological-based ideas. However, for someone like Granger, this meeting with Grieg came to mean something much more. It was, yes, a stamp of approval, but it was also the start of a eugenic wave by which he would try to make a much more universal circulation of what he thought were much more perfectible qualities for the human race, if I could put it that way.
And, of course, we hear the word eugenics and we think Nazi Germany.
Right. But that, of course, did not start in Nazi Germany, and it wasn't necessarily exclusively about medical practices, although, of course, it is intimately tied to that. I've tried to argue the fact that this is a cultural phenomenon that happens first, and it is not something that was sidelined by anyone. It was mainstream practice and thought. And, of course, the term eugenics is also misleading in that it means many different things. People use that term, and, in fact, just like cosmopolitanism, it's the ambiguity of that term that makes it powerful, right? Because if you clearly define these terms and you and I have a conversation, then everyone who doesn't buy into our idea, we can clearly label outsiders, right? But it's the malleability of that term. And the fact that eugenics is about this discourse, it's about the rhetoric. And this is where 19th century writers first set the groundwork for what later become medical practices or social practices that we know all too well and their damaging effects in the 1930s and 40s. But too often, I think we cast that aside as, oh, you know, well, that's extreme. Those were people who were radicalized, right? That only happened in Germany when it was the American writers like Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard, who Granger intimately becomes acquainted with, as corresponds with, learns about some of these writings coming out now in the 19-teens, and then gives a speech at Yale University and says, you know, I hope you all didn't realize the meaning of race. Again, another term that's thrown around here. What does it mean to be of a certain race? Is I just discovered the meaning of race myself. And of course, he's referring to Madison Grant's famous book. So now this biological notion of what it means to be race gets mixed in with his cultural leanings, which favored this, again, ambiguous Nordic definition. And again, what does Nordic mean? Well, it depends what hour of the day he's talking. At one moment, it could be Icelandic. Granger taught himself to read Icelandic from a young age, right? I mean, this is how serious he took this endeavor of his to spread Nordic supremacy.
How do we see this manifested in music? Do we?
It's a brilliant question. I think Granger, certainly this is off the table for Grieg. I think Grieg was also very, very careful to bring in what would be maybe too much of a national flavor to some of his works. I know that I'm probably not explaining that clearly, but for him, it was about layering. It's the sense of we must integrate these layers of our human identity. We all have to do this to this day. Our local identity, our family identity, right? Our personal interests, how they fit in with the region, how that fits in with our country, and how that country fits in with the rest of the world. So it's political, it's social, it's all of these things. But is it artistic? And that's what I try to get at. Are there certain artistic practices? Well, there are, and they also occur in layers. They occur in what you choose to select as your source material, if you choose to do so. So, of course, now we get this issue of folk music coming back. Folk music can at once be an identifier and a marker of your own culture. But again, how much does someone living in an upper middle class family in an urban area have anything to do with this peasant life, right? It is a fantasy that they're perpetuating, but they are not. What I always use in my classes when I talk about this is the image of the previous century of Thoreau, right? Of Thoreau, who's living on the train tracks, right? The absolute hub of human activity, and is pretending that he's in the middle of nowhere. And then at the end just says, well, I have other lives to lead. And that's the end of that, right? If this was so great, what he's offering us and Thoreau's experience, there's so much hypocrisy. And I apologize to literary scholars out there, but he's onto something. So you've got the rhetoric of what he's arguing for, and then you've got the practices. So now to come back to your question, we have the same thing in music. Sometimes, in fact, many times, it's the rhetoric about the folk music that gives that folk music the meaning. So whether that folk music is going to become someone's singular possession. I own this, right? This is my culture. Or is it something that we share? So it brings in these questions of ownership. I don't think, certainly not like language, although language I would argue is equally problematic. It's not as easy to say we own this, right? We could say there's a such thing as the English language, but we know that the English language as we speak it today is not even how we spoke it 5, 6, 7 years ago. And of course, this is changing all the time, especially with the advent of the internet. We know that regional dialects are going away in this country. We're starting to speak a lot more homogeneous. So therefore, you know, you have this issue in language, the way in which we mark things, and we assume that they've always been that way, right? That they're fixed. But in music, it's a bit more difficult because we share, for the most part, the same language. And it, no matter where you come from, there's a major scale throughout much of the Western culture. We share that in common. We share the forms that we use, like concerto, so on and so forth. We share chord progressions. And there are certain things that maybe are used more often in Nordic music than in other cultures. But again, you know, you have certain progressions. What does it mean to play an open fifth on the piano without filling it in? Well, if you go to a place like Norway, they're going to say, well, this is our folk music, but you could play the same thing in Bohemia. And they'd say, oh, well, that sounds like my culture, right? So it's the rhetoric about these musical devices that give it the meaning. And that's why I've tried to focus on the connection between what was going on in literature, understanding that's not the only influence, but it was a big influence, and then what was going on in music. Because it's not like we could hold it up to a microscope and say, ah, I found the thing that makes this Norwegian, right? Or I found the thing that makes this something else. But that's how people were talking in that period. This is how people were trying to say, ah, this is Norwegian music and here is the identifier. And I think Grieg struggled to say, how do I get myself out of this puzzle? There's no clear identifier to say I'm cosmopolitan. That's the whole point of cosmopolitanism. But then therefore, to a lot of people then, it's a problem. Well, you obviously don't have any allegiances. You obviously are not faithful, right? You obviously don't love your country. All these other very negative things that were certainly very much in the press at that time. And then, of course, you have another layer, which is what we want to see in our idols. And as we all know, that can be a very different story than what they try to craft themselves. So that's a real roundabout way to say, yes, there are certain things in music, but it's the meanings that we all as audience members and as practitioners bring to the music that I've tried to really try to decontextualize.
Do you think Grieg would hope that as he's struggling with and creating his later works, that the experience of listening to music might help us in our humanity in some way? How did he feel about being a composer? What did he feel the power of music was?
Well, you know, I think if anything, what writing this book did was, and I don't want to sound pessimistic here, but it's actually show how difficult what we were talking about is to achieve, because people hear what they want to hear. And this is always the case. So for Grieg, the sense that music can bring people together across barriers, whether they be cultural, whatever the case might be, was always a goal. But so often, you can't change the way people perceive it. It's that classic tension between intention and reception. People will receive it a certain way. So, for instance, Dan Grimley, who's written, I think, most extensively about Grieg's late work and how he used landscape and all these other aspects in his music, he does so. But the end of it is not to say, my country, and, you know, end of story, full stop. But my country as part of this larger network of number of things. And I think that that's really the key here is how far are we willing to spread our allegiances? And is that spread a strength or a weakness? That's another layer of that is how we interpret that. So to come back to your question of can it bring us together? Yes, but it always risks driving people apart at the same time. And that's the trouble. And I think it's an awareness of that. I don't in the book prescribe solutions to this. But I think it's being aware of how we unify and divide at the same time, whether the composer intends it or not. And that is based upon location and time. And the more we're willing to understand the fluid nature of ways we create meaning and the ways that we put ourselves into stories to create that meaning, I think that's where we move towards creating answers, both diplomatically, economically, and indeed culturally. And because otherwise you spend the rest of your life trying to divvy things up and put them in boxes. And unfortunately, that way tends to be, you know, a fight that often becomes violent. because you can put things in boxes all day long and say, well, what you put in that box really belongs to me. And that's precisely what I think Grieg was trying to use cosmopolitanism as a way to avoid that.
So timely, Ryan, and getting to the heart of more than just music, more than just literature, but again, to who we are and how we live with each other as human beings, right?
Absolutely. It's a project, and it's a project that we all participate in, whether we realize it or not. We participate in it in different ways. But I think the goal and one of the major challenges is to avoid a sense of attachment that might become unhealthy. But of course, how do we describe and how do we define what's unhealthy? I think that's also very, very difficult, but where the heart of a lot of very good discussion can begin.
Dr. Ryan Weber, assistant professor of musicology in the Department of Fine Arts and a member of the Medical and Health Humanities Program faculty at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, recently authoring the book Cosmopolitanism and Transatlantic Circles in Music and Literature, published by Palgrave Macmillan as part of the interdisciplinary series Palgrave Studies in Music and Literature. Dr. Weber presented details from the book at the Birth of Contemporary Europe, World War I Music and Arts at an International Music and Political Science Conference in Athens, Greece, in November 2018. For more information on the web, misericordia.edu, yes, MISERICORDIA, misericordia.edu, and palgrave.com, PALGRAVE, palgrave.com. That's Dr. Ryan Weber, 1B, W-E-B-E-R, and he's just published Cosmopolitanism and Transatlantic Circles in Music and Literature, and that study is published by Palgrave Macmillan.